Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Sir Harry Burns, who is the Professor of Global Public Health at the University of Strathclyde and a former Chief Medical Officer for Scotland. He's going to talk to us today about the causes of wellness. Hello, Harry. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me.
Okay, could you maybe begin by telling us a bit about your background and how you initially became interested in this subject?
Okay, I started out my medical career in surgery. I was a surgeon for about 15 years. I worked as a consultant surgeon in the Royal Infirmary in Glasgow. And that's a hospital that serves some of the poorest areas of the United Kingdom. And it was very obvious to me that the level of ill health that I experienced there was unlikely to be explained very easily by conventional explanations. Yeah, people smoked a lot and they drank too much and so on. But we noticed strange things. I'd worked previously in more affluent areas. And when I went to the Royal, the first thing I noticed was people took longer to heal their wounds. And we thought, well, poor nutrition might be the explanation for that. But over the years, it became obvious to me that there was something else going on. And we did some studies that showed that some biochemical differences may be associated with being very poor. So that prompted me to move out of surgery and get into public health. And over the years, I was fortunate enough to be able to work with a lot of people who were also interested in the same area. And we've pulled together an analysis of the social and economic determinants of well-being that kind of suggests that, yes, indeed, there are quite significant handicaps that people born and brought up in difficult circumstances acquire during life that increase their risk of premature death. So that's in essence where we've got to in our journey, our sort of 30-year journey of trying to understand this area.
Okay, and then what research specifically did you work with to take this forward?
Well, I think that the first thing that was important was actually understanding what the causes of inequality in health are. I mean, people talk about differences in life expectancy between affluent and deprived areas of not just of Glasgow or Scotland, but the whole world sees differences in life expectancy as you go down the socioeconomic scale. And the first thing we did, I think, was challenge this notion that poor people are just feckless, you know, they're just, they don't grasp the necessity to live healthy lives. And we did that by analysing what the causes of premature death were. And most people would assume that the differences in life expectancy between rich and poor are down to the fact that poor people are more likely to get heart disease and cancer. In fact, it's much more profound than that. When we analysed the pattern of inequality in death rates in Glasgow, we found that the widest inequalities were actually in the younger population.
Interesting.
The age between about 15 and 45 as the period where inequalities in death rates are at their widest. Now, the actual number of people dying in that age range is obviously lower than it is in people 75 and over, but the inequality is stark. And the main drivers of that inequality are not heart disease and cancer. They're things like alcohol, drugs, violence, suicide. They're problems that are very clearly laid out and caused by socioeconomic circumstances. You know, we're not going to fix these issues, the drugs, alcohol, suicide and violence, by fiddling with the fat content of diets. It's much more profound than that.
Yeah.
So we then began to try and understand what it was that led to the emergence of these problems in society. And the other, this was the other strange thing we noticed, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. You know, we have this idea of the Scotsman as being a sort of happy drunk, if you like. In fact, up until about, I don't know, about 1995, Scots had, when you look at Western Europe, Scottish death rates from alcoholic liver disease are amongst the lowest in Western Europe. Mm. And then between 1990 and about 2005, they became the highest in Western Europe.
Wow.
There was a recent change in the pattern of risk of death that probably goes back to about the 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah.
The emergence of these problems probably began to be associated with the difficulties of employment and poverty and poor housing and dislocation of communities and society that we saw emerging really when shipyards and steelworks and so on closed in West Central Scotland.
Right.
So suddenly the problem was not how do you get people to stop smoking? The problem was, well, how do you create something different in the population that turned a population that had all the diseases of hopelessness into something more positive? How do we create wellness, really, was the question we asked ourselves.
Yeah.
Instead of focusing on conventional illness, how do we create within people a sense of wanting to be positive about their lives and wanting to be in control of their lives?
Presumably that's quite an assumption to challenge, because people often associated it with illness.
Yes. I mean, it's understandable that they would associate it with illness, because in the 20th century, medical science was so successful in making people better, in curing diseases that had previously been incurable. Things like diabetes, the discovery of insulin, suddenly people who would just lapse into a coma and never surface again could be wakened up and could begin to live their lives normally, or reasonably normally again. Tuberculosis, which was a huge killer in the 20th century, was curable when they discovered streptomycin. Vaccines, polio, great disabler of children in the 20th century. In the 1950s, Jonas Salk finds a vaccine for it, and suddenly the outlook is different.
Yep.
So we've become used to this idea, not only that medical science can make us well, but there is a single cause or a single lever you can pull. You know, it's like a machine. You find this vaccine, you find that antibiotic, and suddenly life is transformed. In fact, the whole idea of making people well, as opposed to just preventing or curing illness, involves a very complex set of ideas. Mm-hmm. And when you begin to look at the causes of wellness as opposed to the causes of illness, you begin to realize that there are some very deep-seated psychological, social drivers of wellness. And people who have studied this whole area, the term over the years that has been coined to explain it is salutogenesis, the opposite of pathogenesis. Pathogenesis is what doctors study, the causes of disease. Salus was the Roman goddess of well-being, and she was also the Roman goddess of safety, which is an interesting juxtaposition, that to be well, you have to feel safe, which seems self-evident, but it's the Romans obviously appreciated it. So this idea of what creates wellness in people has been studied extensively by a number of people. And, you know, just to pick out some of the ideas that have contributed to it, I suppose one of the most notable books that's been written about it is a book called Man's Search for Meaning, written by an Austrian psychotherapist called Viktor Frankl, who talked about his 5 years as a prisoner in Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And how he described how he and the men who were with him who survived, what was it that allowed them to survive? And he talks about purpose and meaning, what he says in the introduction to his book is if you have a why to live, you can cope with almost any how. You can cope with adverse circumstances if you have a strong enough purpose. Other people who have explored why it is children grow up to be successful across all domains in life, and wellness, I suppose, would describe success not just in health terms, but success in educational terms and relationship terms and so on, talk about the ability to feel confident that you can cope with what life throws at you. You can understand the world, you feel confident you can cope, and you want to cope. You have a meaning in life. Extroverts, optimists, seem to do better than pessimists. Now, whether that's cause or effect, or, you know, just how it's associated, we don't know. But there are a number of psychological characteristics that are associated with a positive sense of well-being and better health. So the question then becomes, how do you create that? What are the origins of this positive mindset, the ability to adapt and change in the face of life's challenges? And the conclusion that we've reached on the basis of a lot of investigation of these circumstances is that the basis of this positive outlook is really laid down in childhood. It's really laid down not just in childhood, but actually there are influences pre-birth that influence it that we now discover, really quite profound influences, that children who experience a stable, consistent, nurturing childhood are far more likely to develop these positive psychological markers of well-being than children who experience chaos, who don't get consistent parenting, who don't attach to parents. It's almost as if the lack of attachment, the attachment process in early life, leads to lack of empathy in later life. The children who experience the chaotic early years are more likely to have mental health problems. When they go to school, they're more likely to fail at school. If they fail at school, they might drift into offending behavior, you know, drift into alcohol, drugs, go to jail. And when I speak to young people in jail, and I, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time doing that, they consider their lives as being finished. You know, 17, 18, there's no hope for them. They're not going to get jobs, so they might as well just shrink away into the darkness. And this takes us on to the notion of alienation, that people who don't feel part of society and are by definition alienated from society, they're the ones who don't experience a sense of wellness. They're the ones who are unemployed, who drift off into the fringes of society. So the challenge, I think, that we have is how do we support parents in these turbulent economic times to provide safe and secure homes for their children so that they develop this positive mental outlook that allows them to participate fully in society and to fulfill their full human potential. You know, I get very frustrated when I hear governments talk about, you know, the purpose of government is to grow the economy. No, it should be to ensure that every human being can develop his talents for the service of others. You know, that's basically what society is about, I think.
Okay. Would it be possible just to unpack a little bit more this idea of salutogenesis? For example, you've been very influenced by the work of Aaron Antonovsky.
Yep.
And he talks about three specific things that are integral to this idea.
Yep. Antonovsky studied the health of adults whose children had been in concentration camps. And he found that when they grew up, 70% of them were damaged in some way. You know, they had poor health, they had poor social environments and so on. But 30% of them had done well. And his conclusion after many, many interviews and so on was that the successful individuals had acquired in early life what he described as a sense of coherence, a sense that the world was structured and predictable. They could analyze what was going on around about them, and they could understand what was going on around about them. The second thing they had was a feeling that they could manage the events round about them. So the world was manageable. And the third thing was that they wanted to engage with it, that they wanted to make the effort. They wanted to get out of bed in the morning to grapple with the challenges life would throw at them. So seeing the world as structured, predictable, manageable and meaningful, Antonovsky said, that constitutes a sense of coherence.
And how does that happen? When a baby cries, for example, or needs a cuddle, they get that response.
There is a famous study which looks at the outcome in macaque monkeys according to how the mother was allowed to feed them. Some monkeys were that the mother had free access to food. Anytime monkey was hungry, the mother could just reach out, get food and feed it. The second group, the food was left a long distance away, so mum had to leave the baby and go off and be absent from the baby for a long time, getting the food and coming back. And they measured stress in the stress hormones in the babies of these two groups.
Yeah.
In fact, the stress hormones were the same. It wasn't mum being there all the time or mum being away all the time. The babies were stressed when they randomly changed the feeding pattern from one day to the next. It was baby not knowing if mum was going to be there or not. So baby didn't learn that the world was structured and predictable. The human equivalent of that might be a mother who was an addict. And sometimes mum would feed the baby when he was crying, but sometimes she would be under the influence of whatever her addiction was, and she couldn't. So baby doesn't learn that the world is structured and predictable. He cries. He's genetically programmed to cry whenever he feels hunger. And sometimes the response is appropriate and sometimes nothing happens.
Right.
So the world is not structured and predictable, and he's not in control. The baby who gets the structured response learns that there is a predictable outcome to me feeling this thing that he doesn't know is hunger, but, you know, he feels there's something not right. Predictable response, the adverse feeling goes away in the light of being fed, and he has control over it. Feels the discomfort, cries, it goes away. He's in control.
Yeah.
If that pattern, if by the time that sort of tennis match, some people describe it as, baby serves the cry into the relationship. What happens next depends on what the return is. By the time he serves a cry 1,000 times and he gets 1,000 predictable returns, he knows, he lays down in his brain patterns of response that shows, right, that bit of the world is structured and predictable, I have control, and he can move forward and begin to test other things. If you don't get that, the world is an uncertain place, and what happens is he upregulates survival responses, upregulates the stress response, which is an important part of the survival response, upregulates emotional ability, you know, because he has to be on an emotional hair trigger to be able to respond to threat and so on. And you get a very different pattern of socialization in those circumstances. Instead of going out and wanting to engage and knowing the rules for engagement with other people, you are just not sure what kind of response you're going to get. You're not sure how to respond in challenging social circumstances. And you respond by essentially an active fight or flight response. You know, it's about survival. It's not about exploration. It's not about exploring the world and learning about it. It's about ducking and diving, just doing the right thing to survive. So you get a very different psychological pattern and a very different pattern of response to the external world.
And presume you can actually see this in the neurobiology of your brain, that certain parts of your brain get larger that are to do with anxiety and stress, and the ones that are to do with, as you say, exploration and making the world comprehensible are diminished in a sense.
The guy who has really done a huge amount of work on this is an American professor of neurobiology called Bruce McEwen. Bruce and a whole range of researchers who've worked with him have shown that key bits of the brain do not develop so well in babies whose early years lack this consistent response, particularly the prefrontal cortex, which is the bit of the brain that allows you to make sense of the world, allows you to take in new information and respond appropriately. That doesn't develop so well. The hippocampus, which integrates short and long-term memory, doesn't develop so well, so learning capacity is reduced. The hippocampus is also hugely involved in suppressing the stress response. And when the hippocampus is not developing the key bits of that stress response, then that's what leads to the chronic elevation in stress. And then there's a bit of the brain called the amygdala that's active when you are emotionally aroused, and it becomes more active. This is the bit of the brain that allows you you're likely to be more anxious and aggressive and fearful. This is the sort of emotional hair trigger that allows you to respond very quickly to threat. But because the other bits of the brain aren't really developed, you sometimes respond inappropriately to threat. Right. So you begin to see a pattern in children brought up in difficult circumstances whereby they don't behave appropriately in new social circumstances, they don't learn so well, and they are anxious, aggressive, fearful. Mm-hmm. As opposed to children who've had a safe upbringing that allows them to say, I can manage threat, now I want to go off and explore and learn.
Mm-hmm. And what's the connection with life having meaning? Is it because life is so stressful and unpleasant that they struggle to make sense in that sense of why they're here or why they want to be here?
That's a good question. And I suppose there's another researcher called Maslow who came up with an important hierarchy of human need. And Maslow said that we can get in, you know, that basically that his hierarchy says that the creative bits of our life, the sort of self-actualization, you know, defining us as people, can only really occur if we feel safe and secure and our basic needs for food and shelter and so on are met first. We can only move up to this higher plane of looking for meaning and so on. And when you look around at food banks and austerity and the way in which unemployed people are sanctioned by Department of Work and pensions and they don't have any money to feed themselves and so on, we are really cutting away the feet. Yeah. We're cutting away that very basic bit of security from people. It's no wonder that they can't start to engage with the more intellectual side of life.
So rather than finding drugs to, in a way, sticking plasters for these biological issues, then presumably it makes more sense to change the chaotic circumstances themselves.
This is how Scotland has elected to begin this process. We have a program going around earlier years where the stated aim is to make Scotland the best place in the world to grow up. And, you know, I said that recently down in London and was met with a bit of a sort of raised eyebrow and, you know, don't be ridiculous, you can't do that. Well, actually, you can. Yeah. And you certainly won't if you don't try. Exactly. And so we've set ourselves outcomes like reducing infant mortality by 15% by the end of 2015, making sure that 90% of all children going to school have attained all their developmental milestones and so on. And you then break that down into, well, what do you need to do in order to achieve that? The philosophy underpinning this is the same philosophy that produced all these gold medals for the British cycling team. Big gains come from attention to lots of small detail. So what are the small things that you do that will transform childhood? Well, having bedtime stories will have an implication there. So all the nursery schools in Scotland got together and said, well, how can we encourage parents to read bedtime stories? And they've tried lots of different things. They collect day-to-day data on how many of our children had bedtime stories last night. What did we do that was successful? What did we do that didn't work? That's shared and goes across the whole of Scotland. We don't do projects anymore. We do things at scale. So the Early Years Collaborative has set off with that. We've now got a Raising Attainment Collaborative. Early Years goes from -9 months to 8. Raising Attainment Collaborative is from 8 to 18. And it's beginning to unravel the things around school culture, the things around home culture, relationships with parents, that what can we do to enhance that for teenage years and so on. And making lots of small changes consistently across the whole of society will move the whole of society in a new direction. So consistent, evidence-based change that we know we're delivering at scale should produce dramatic results, I would hope, around those early years. Things like the young people who've already drifted away from society and are in prison, we need to be looking at how do we reattach them to society. We know that they're emotionally labile. How can we help them manage their emotions? And things like mindfulness and so on are being tried to do that kind of thing. Again, consistently with young offenders. Things like making sure that they have jobs. When they leave prison, they say to me, well, I'm never going to get a job. You know, I'll just sit at home and drink. And if they're sitting at home and drinking and watching television, at some point a baby will come along and the cycle is repeated. The cycle of chaos is repeated. Well, how can we give them meaning in their lives by giving them jobs? Yeah. So social enterprises and so on are very important in that. And so there are a whole range of things that you can do that will help deliver this sort of society. And we are blessed, that's the only word for it, in Scotland, with politicians who really understand this and want to co-produce these outcomes with broader society.
Yeah, you mentioned a person that has really inspired you in regard to getting involved in the community is a guy in the States called Greg Boyle and his Homeboy Bakeries. Could you just give us a quick talk about that?
Well, I met Greg last year. He came over to Glasgow at the invitation of a thing called the Violence Reduction Unit, which was set up initially by the police. And his story is that 20 odd years ago, he was sent to a parish in South Los Angeles that was in the middle of the Latino gang area. And he arrived at the parish, dumped his bag in the house and went for a walk. And he said he got about 100 yards down the road and a police car stopped him and said, if you carry on down this road, Father, you'll be dead before very long. And he said, well, that's what we do. That's what we're here to do. And he carried on. And 20 years later, he has helped transform the lives of literally thousands of these Latino gang members. The process began when he stopped and talked to them. He learned their names. He began to treat them as individuals, whereas before they would have experienced a bit of domestic violence, they would have been neglected by parents, they would have seen a violent father and so on. And that was all they knew. And yet here was this man who was obviously educated, finding pleasure in their company.
Yeah.
And that helped them attain a bit of self-esteem. And they realized that the lives they were leading did not have to be, it wasn't inevitable. They could have choices. He persuaded a film producer friend of his to buy a disused bakery, and Homeboy Bakery started. He employed the guys. As he said, I bake bread to employ people. I don't employ people to bake bread, you know? And very quickly he realized he had to start a second business, which was Homeboy Tattoo Removal, because they had gang tattoos and that was a cause of dissension in the bakery. So he got a plastic surgeon friend of his to give him a laser. And this guy taught the gang members how to remove their tattoos with this laser. And this just developed. Now, it wasn't you know, he said there were many tragedies along the way, many people that he, whose lives were changed, were sucked back into the gang culture and their past history caught up with them and so on. But when he came to Glasgow, he brought with him an ex-head of Los Angeles Police Department who said, Father Boyle showed us that we couldn't arrest our way out of trouble, that the sole circumstances needed to be fixed in order to fix this problem. And at lunchtime on the day he was over with us, I took him to a school where he spoke to the school kids. One of the school kids asked him, what's the difference between us as 14-year-olds here in Scotland and the 14-year-olds that you see in Los Angeles? And he said, the difference is you have a sense of the future. You are here because you can see a life ahead of you. You're wanting to build that life through education and working hard at school, and you've got the support of your parents. 14-year-old in South Los Angeles is not thinking beyond the next 24 hours because he's seen his friends killed in drive-by shootings and so on. He's got no sense that he has a life to build. And so it's purpose and meaning again.
Yeah.
But the other really good thing he said, and it's something that has stayed with me and something that I think we all need to bear in mind, is that we need to find within ourselves a compassion that stands in awe at the burdens the poor have to carry, rather than stands in judgment at the way they carry those burdens. And it's absolutely beautiful there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really powerful, yeah.
He basically made the argument that we all belong to each other,
yeah.
That we have a duty to look out for each other, no matter how far down the scale someone has fallen, they are still part of the human race, and we need to be supporting them and helping them pick themselves up.
Sure. Do you also find it encouraging, the latest research on the plasticity of the brain? We talked at the beginning about how, to an extent, people's brains get hardwired by neglect and a dysfunctional setting. But the example of Greg Boyle and the people in the Holden Boy Bakeries, a lot of them managed to actually turn their lives around and actually become more compassionate and empathic.
When I started piecing all of this together maybe 7 or 8 years ago, the neurobiology side of it was a work in progress. It's still a work in progress. But you're right, we've learned a lot more. And it's interesting, I spoke to a guy who knew Aaron Antonovsky, a guy called John Kabat-Zinn.
Oh,
you know John, he's written many, many books on mindfulness.
Yeah.
And he started out in mindfulness, doing mindfulness sessions for cancer patients at Massachusetts Medical School. And he measured Antonovsky's sense of coherence as just part of his research around this. And he found that mindfulness significantly increased sense of coherence. So he phoned Antonovsky and he said, Aaron, I've just increased sense of coherence by whatever it was in these elderly cancer patients. And Antonovsky said, impossible. Sense of coherence is laid down by the age of 3 and you can't alter it afterwards. So John said, by the time he repeated the study 20 times, he knew that he was right and Antonovsky was wrong. There is no question that we can continue to develop the brain throughout life. Some of Bruce McEwen's researchers have shown new brain cells still being created in terminally ill cancer patients in their 70s and 80s. The trick is to put those brain cells to use. If you don't use them, you lose them. So throughout life, there is still an opportunity to develop areas like the hippocampus and so on. It requires work. You know, it requires continued study, learning, experiencing new things and so on. But we have learned a lot about that. The other science that has moved forward considerably is the science of epigenetics, because we know that the mechanism by which the stress response is upregulated is one in which genes in the cell nucleus, which code for part of the mechanism for suppressing the stress response, get turned off in neglected children. Those genes just never get activated because some of the chemicals needed to activate them are generated through happiness and contentment. We now are beginning to see some evidence that this epigenetic process might be reversible also.
Interesting.
So we need to be as optimistic and positive as possible and just accept that throughout life we can transform our prospects.
Okay. Now, you've been very active in promoting health and support for mothers, but some families are also terribly dysfunctional and intervention may well make a difference. What are your thoughts on early intervention and removal of those children from those families?
Well, there's no question that in some circumstances, for the child's safety, they have to be removed. But in Glasgow, the health board and the clinicians in Glasgow involved with child safety have been working with a professor of paediatrics from New Orleans, Professor Charlie Zena. And in the state of Louisiana, any child who is being considered for removal from the parental home has to be assessed by Charlie Zena's associates. He's developed a system for assessing whether or not, with support, it's safe for children to go back home. Can he work with the parents? Can they work with the child in order to bring the family back together again? So we've adopted this system. We're assessing it to see just how successful it is. My guess is that it might not mean that we reduce the number of children taken into care, but it will probably mean that we will be far more confident that the children that go back to the parental home are going back to a safe place. I think at the moment, the safety of the child becomes paramount. And if children are taken into care, the challenge then becomes, how do we make sure that they are taken into the kind of environment that enhances their capacities? Bouncing around foster homes is another form of inconsistency.
Yeah.
So a safe, secure place where the child feels loved and wanted is the absolutely essential element to all of this.
Okay. Do you think what we've been talking about is to some extent a Western thing, this relationship between poverty and stress? I mentioned this partly through my own experience. I remember spending a few months in India in my 20s and encountering extreme poverty, but not the same degree of hopelessness or lack of meaning. I don't know if you've ever come across that yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, the parenting culture obviously differs slightly from one area to the next, but the innate biological need to love a child is with us all. And when you see that being eroded, you have to look and see what's the basis of the erosion. And I think disintegration of societal norms is behind it all. You talk to people who have worked with native communities in North America and Australia and so on, and I've heard it said by people with native communities that if you dislocate a society from its traditional basis, you get this kind of chaos. You get people retreat into themselves. They do not show loving patterns of love and affection to within families and so on. Families start to disintegrate. And I think we need a stable set of answers out there. We need a stable culture. And that culture in the West is being eroded by austerity, where in Greece, you get reports of parents handing their babies over to strangers in the street because they can't look after them anymore. I mean, it's just horrible what's being done to us in the name of the economy. And I don't accept that this austerity is the only answer. You know, I just don't accept that we should be servants of economic growth rather than the other way around. Our function as a society is to make sure that every human being develops his full potential, and the economy should serve that, not the other way around. So I think in the West, we have been particularly damaged by the last few years.
Yeah. So it's more about society's role is more about getting everyone to flourish as human beings rather than being homo economicus.
Absolutely. I mean, there are very profound economic reasons why we should concentrate on flourishing, because we're going to need, you know, the challenges of climate change, the challenges of disease emerging in all sorts of ways and so on. A whole range of challenges will face us over the next century, and we're going to need all of those people, all of their brains working full tilt to solve these problems. But we shouldn't do it because it's economically sensible to have everyone working and bringing their talents to the full benefit of society. We could do it because it's just. We should do it because it's the right thing to do. Yeah. It's morally unacceptable to continue starving our people, which is essentially what the sanctioning regime in Department of Work and Pensions does. I hear of people who don't eat for 3 or 4 days. I was hearing the other day about a woman whose diet consists of six biscuits a day, 2 in the morning, 2 at lunchtime, 2 at the evening. I mean, this is unspeakably cruel. Yeah. And it needs to stop.
Yeah. Okay, well, my last question, Harry. We've touched on themes such as flourishing, self-actualization, mindfulness, etc., and Homo economicus and Homo empathicus. What is your understanding of the middle way, if any, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I mean, it's not something that I've been particularly involved with, but it feels to me that the way ahead for us as a sentient species, which, you know, in the past few days with this, the audacity of our species landing something on a NASA, on a comet, 500 million kilometers, you know, we do astonishing things.
Yeah.
We do astonishing things. And I have a new granddaughter. She's 6 months old. She's liable to live into the 22nd century. I would like her to continue to be astonished and to feel safe and to develop and so on. The only way our children and grandchildren are going to have the opportunities that we've had is love and compassion for everyone. Not love and compassion for those that hold a British passport and disdain for those who come seeking shelter from elsewhere, an acceptance of us all as human beings, we all have something to contribute, if only we are allowed to develop the capacity to contribute it. To me, the middle way, I suppose, is not going down extremes of economic growth, or, you know, but to accept the humanity that's in us all and to work on ways of increasing that humanity and spreading it. And I don't know if that's what you would understand, but it's what certainly motivates me.
Yeah. I can very much relate to that, Harry. Thank you very much for talking to me today, Harry. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.